The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. During your study abroad semester, you'll encounter ancient and medieval Rome as a crossroads of intellectual traditions from Europe, Africa, and the Middle East as they inform St. Thomas and his major works. But it's not just about academics. You'll experience profound spiritual formation with opportunities for prayer, community, and pilgrimages that deepen your faith. Our excursions aren't just sightseeing. They're a chance to walk in the footsteps of saints like St. Dominic and St. Catherine of Siena through places like Siena and Florence and more. Applications for spring 2026 close August 15th. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Thank you so much for those kind words of introduction. I should maybe apologize in advance, unlike most of the talks that will take place over this conference that are going to deal with the creed front and center, beginning to end. My talk is really going to take the creed as point of departure for what I'd like to say about the relationship of the Old and New Testaments, specifically the notion that the creed, I think, is deeply indebted to. That is the notion that the Christological mystery is unfolds in a way that is in accordance with the scriptures, meaning precisely that of the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament. Okay, and I have the slide I have up here. I won't address these two thinkers in my talk, but they certainly reflect the spirit that I wish to address. The top quote from St. Thomas Aquinas about the importance of the sacramental law in the Old Testament. I'm not a scholar of St. Thomas, but as I understand it, this is one of the longest sections in the Summa, certainly something of deep and abiding interest to St. Thomas, but also one of the most understudied parts of his work among modern scholars. I think it's deeply dependent, most likely, on St. Augustine's Contra Faustus and the desire to show that within these portions of the Hebrew Scriptures, one could learn or derive quite a bit of theology about the person and work of Jesus Christ. And then in a kind of similar vein, but from a much more modern perspective, one of my favorite Old Testament scholars, Brevard Childs, the late Brevard Childs of Yale, Divinity School. Here he's really citing the work or recycling the work of Von. Oh, am I not speaking into that? I'm sorry. My wife tells me I didn't never need a microphone, but perhaps I do. She says I'm constitutionally incapable of whispering, but in any event, I'll try and stay by the microphone. Brevard Childs deriving his thinking here from the great German scholar of the early church, Von Kampfenhausen. Writes that the problem of the early church was not what to do with the Old Testament in light of the gospel, a distinctively modern problem, but rather the reverse, in light of the Jewish scriptures, how were Christians to understand Jesus Christ? Okay, having said that, I'm ready to begin. My lecture today will explore the notion that our understanding and veneration of Jesus has unfolded, quote, in accordance with the scriptures. I'll take my point of departure from one of Benedict XVI's last essays, his reflections on the priestly office. There he argued that the failure of the modern church to properly appreciate this office was due, in no small measure, to its inability to read the Old Testament. Already at the end of the first century, as he observes, the church was using Levitical terminology to unpack the nature of its sacerdotal offices, cf. First Clement. A similar thing happened, I would contend, with the way in which the church understood its sacred architecture. It adopted and adapted much of the picture drawn by the revelation of the tabernacle in the book of Exodus. And to that point, I will now turn. Is there an extra handout that I could have so I can make sure I refer to it? I understand they're in short supply, but I'm happily willing to, you know, sell this to an interested auditor today after the lecture. Okay. Any consideration of the tabernacle narrative must begin with two dramatic appearances of the God of Israel after its construction. The first takes place after Moses has finished setting up the structure, and that's the first text on your handout, Exodus 40, the very last paragraph there, verses 34 and 35. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the Kavod Adonai, the glory of the Lord, filled the tabernacle. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it. The glory of the Lord had filled the tabernacle. And then the second takes place once the priests have been ordained and the first public sacrifices have been prepared and set on the altar. That's Leviticus 9, the second text on that first page. Moses and Aaron entered the tent of meeting and then came out and blessed the people. And the glory of the Lord, again, the Kavod Adonai, appeared to all the people. Fire came out from the Lord, consumed the burnt offering and the fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Now, what's striking about this presentation is the temporal relationship between these two texts. One might assume that the relationship is quite straightforward. First, erect the tabernacle, as dated in Exodus 40 on the 1st of Nisan. And then, 8 days later, as described at the beginning of Leviticus 9, the first sacrifices will be offered. Yet, when we begin to examine pre-modern interpreters, we'll find that the picture gets quite murky. One place to begin our examination would be with the Babylonian Talmud. In the tractate on Shabbat, we have a text that reads, with respect to the 1st of Nisan, that the 1st of Nisan is a day that bore 10 crowns. It's the first day of creation, the first day for the tribal chieftains, the first day for priesthood, the first for public sacrifices, the first for the descent of the altar fire, that's Leviticus 9, the first for the eating of sacrificial food, and then, important, the first for the indwelling of the Shekhinah, the divine presence, Exodus 40. So according to this text, on the 1st of Nisan, both of these events take place at one and the same time, something different than I think most people would presume from the simple sense of the way in which these chapters are laid out. But we don't have to turn to the Babylonian Talmud to see evidence of, we might want to call this, temporal confusion. We can see it already in the Bible itself, a good example of what we might call interbiblical interpretation. The book of Chronicles, as it describes the founding of the temple under King Solomon, benefits, of course, from its knowledge of the priestly writings in the Torah, and adjusts the narrative that we find in the book of Kings to be in sync with what we've learned about the priestly from the priestly document in the Torah. And what's striking there, this is text 3 there on your handout, is that the way in which that we have described the denouement, as it were, of this temple building moment for King Solomon is a combination of these two theophanies, a combination of the text from Exodus 40 and Leviticus 9. They're woven in together as though they're describing simply one event. When Solomon had ended his prayer, Leviticus 9, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering. And then as soon as Leviticus 9 is done, boom, we go back to Exodus 40. And the glory of the Lord filled the temple. That's Exodus 40. The priests could not enter the house of the Lord, just like Moses couldn't, because the glory is there. Then verse 3, back to Leviticus 9, when all the people of Israel saw the fire come down. Boom, back to Exodus 40, the glory of the Lord on the temple. Then boom, back to Leviticus 9, they bowed down on the pavement, etc., etc. Clearly a text that has woven together Exodus 40 and Leviticus 9 as though they're describing a single moment in time. So one question one might want to ask, having seen this, is, well, why didn't the author of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, why didn't our author there write a story of the founding of Israel's cult like we find it in the book of Chronicles? My answer would be that the presentation of the material in the Pentateuch is both thematic and chronological. If chronology was the only concern, then the story would come to its climax with the offering of the first sacrifices. The logical conclusion from such a presentation would be that the role of the tabernacle building itself is purely instrumental. It provides the location or site where sacrifices can be offered. But for our priestly author, the tabernacle is far more important than this. It doesn't simply have an instrumental function to provide the place at which sacrifice can occur. It also has a good in unto itself. That is, it is the place where God dwells. And appropriately, of course, these verses are utilized in the prologue of John. Logos dwelt, tabernacled, skenoo in Greek, deriving from Exodus 40, dwelt among us, and we beheld its glory, the doxa in Greek, reflecting the kavod Adonai from Exodus 40. So the tabernacle is the place where God dwells. And this needs special emphasis. Each of these themes, though interconnected, also possess, I would like to say, a certain independence. This can be seen in the distinctive spiritual practices that pertain to each of these themes. Let's begin by comparing Psalms 48 and 96. I have Psalm 48, I believe. It's on begins on the bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3. You see, I already made a mistake. Well, anyway, stop. It doesn't matter. Let's begin by comparing Psalm 48 and Psalm 96. The first of these psalms depicts the temple, and by extension the city of Jerusalem, as the spot where God dwells. As a result, visual inspection of its architecture becomes a sacred act, a way of contemplating God. Walk about Zion, go all around it, count its towers, consider well its ramparts, go through its citadels, that you may tell the next generation that this is God, our God forever. He will be our guide forever. If we turn to the next text on your handout there on page 3, I think that the Jewish commentator Amos Chacham captures the spirituality of this psalm quite accurately when he writes, regarding this expression, this is God, this is Elohim in Hebrew, the word this is similar in meaning to the Hebrew word look here. It's an expression of palpable excitement, and its point is that the one who sees the temple and its splendor and glory feels within himself as if he saw face to face the glory of the Lord. He cries, this, meaning this building, is God, our God. Psalm 96, on the other hand, this isn't on your handout, but you'll recognize it, directs our attention to the other dimension of the temple's revelatory power, the offering of a sacrifice. Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength, ascribe to the Lord glory due his name, bring an offering, come into his courts, worship the Lord in holy splendor, tremble before him all the earth. So let me summarize what I've said so far. We have noted that in the tabernacle narrative, Exodus 25 through Leviticus 10, has two climaxes, two theophanies, two places where the glory of the Lord makes itself visible before the people of Israel, that represent two interrelated but still fundamentally independent theological themes, one of indwelling, incarnation, if we wish to cast it forward into the New Testament, and the other of altar service, or what ultimately will become atonement. And each of these modes of representing the tabernacle call forth a specific type of piety, also important. The former, that of the visual gaze, contemplating the place where God has taken up residence among the Israelites. And second, a sacrificial action. With this in place, we need to return once more to the tabernacle furniture to see why this element of gazing looms so large and why it is that our psalmist can say, as Amos Chacham interprets it, looking at the buildings, this is our God. Okay. My point of departure here will focus on a comparison of Exodus 40 and Numbers 4. So we'll have to go back to page 1 of your handout where we've got Exodus 40, and we will compare it to Numbers 4 on page 2 of your handout. Exodus 40, we might say, seems to perhaps overlap or look very much like a set of instructions you might get with a piece of furniture you buy from IKEA. Tells you how to assemble the pieces. All the pieces now have been built. They've been brought to Moses. He's kind of looking at them. How shall I put them together? Exodus 40 tells you how to do that. And then Numbers 4 is very important because it tells you then how you are supposed to take them apart to prepare them for their travel through the wilderness. And there's both a symmetry and an asymmetry here, important to attend to both. The story of disassemblage here, if we're going to look at Numbers 4, let's take a look at that on page 2. The story of disassemblage breaks into three units, each corresponding to a specific Levitical family, that of the Kohathites, the Gershonites, and the Merarites. It's important to note that these Levitical families are not priests themselves, but servants to the priests, that is, Aaron and his sons. Perhaps a comparable Roman Catholic phenomenon would be the relationship of deacon to priest. The Gershonites and the Merarites are responsible for the less significant pieces, the screens and curtains for the former, and the wooden frames, bars, pillars, and bases for the latter. The inner pieces of sacred furniture, the ark, table, lamp, and two altars, are the responsibility of the Kohathites. And this is where things get interesting. Let's take a look there at the bottom of page 2 to begin with. That is, the responsibilities of the Gershonites. And by extension, we could say everything we're going to see here with respect to the Gershonites would also be true for the Merarites in terms of how they're laid out. Formally, they're quite parallel. The text begins, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take a census of the Gershonites also by their ancestral houses. From 30 to 50 years old, you shall enroll them, all who qualify to do the work of the tent of meeting." Then an important phrase I've underlined here, "This is the service of the clans of the Gershonites in dismantling and carrying." And then, boom, what follows, and I've indented it there, are the objects that they are to dismantle and carry. In other words, we introduce those objects immediately after saying, this is the service of the clans of the Gershonites. Now, the reason why it's important to see that is if we look up above to the Kohathites, we're going to see a very different picture. Things are quite different when we consider this text, which begins, "The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying," just like chapter 4, verse 21. Again, similar, "Take a census of the Kohathites, separate from all the other Levites, by their clans and ancestral houses, from 30 to 50 years old, all who qualify to do the work of the tent of meeting." And this, again, underlining, matching just formally what's going on below. "This is the service of the Kohathites relating to the tent of meeting, the most holy things." And then, boom, the indented material. But the indented material, unlike what we have below, is completely unrelated to what the Kohathites are supposed to do. Instead, we introduce here the figure of Aaron and his sons. Very different than what we have for Gershon and Merari. Somewhat surprisingly here, we read that Aaron and his sons must first step forward to cover and remove the sacred furniture, and only then can the Kohathites come forward to carry them on their journey. And we learn about that when we get down to verse 15, where we'll see then underlined, these are the things of the tent of meeting that the Kohathites are to carry. But notice how late that comes in the presentation of our text here for the beginning of Numbers 4, quite different than what we had for Gershon. The reasons for this extraordinary procedure are quite easy to explain. Going back to Exodus 40, once the glory of the Lord has entered the tabernacle, these items absorb something of the deity himself, such that the unauthorized sight of these objects would prove lethal for all save the priests themselves. In other words, the mortal danger that is normally reserved for seeing God, think of Exodus in chapter 34 or the story of Samson, many places within the Bible where individuals fear seeing God, for to see God would be to lose one's life. that notion that's deep within the Bible, the theology of theophanies here is extended to cover the furniture of the tabernacle. The mortal danger normally reserved for seeing God has somehow become a defining characteristic of the furniture itself. Here we see the consequences of God's condescension to dwell among the Israelites. As when the Holy Spirit descends upon the bread and wine in the Eucharist, those elements leave the realm of everyday items to become the body and blood of Christ. So with the entrance of the glory of God into the tabernacle, the ontological character of the furniture within the tabernacle forever changes. So there's a huge difference between Exodus 40 and Numbers 4. We're no longer in an IKEA store. You can put together your bookshelf and take it apart as many times as you wish. Nothing changes. It's still the same bookshelf. But in Exodus 40, you assemble the thing, God enters it, then boom, its character is forever changed. The items within the tabernacle take on something of the character of God. So let's step back and consider the nature of this transformation. In my recent book, That I May Dwell Among Them, I called this phenomenon ontological leakage. And by this, I meant that the moment the tabernacle was indwelt by the glory of the Lord, this glory was so overwhelming that it could not be contained within the Holy of Holies. Something of that presence leaked out of the Holy of Holies and penetrated the most sacred items of the tabernacle's antechamber. They became quasi-deified. And so the same type of reverence and awe that defined the very being of God could be transferred to the furniture that attended his presence. In a wide variety of Second Temple texts, this notion informed the way in which the furniture was treated during the moment of the temple's destruction. In many of these texts, these items were hidden away by Jeremiah and left, as it were, under lock and key until the moment of the temple's final reconstruction, when they would finally be revealed and found. In other texts, they were directly ported into heaven, and the final rebuilding of the temple would constitute the moment in which God would allow them to return. In any event, these texts could not be treated, these pieces of furniture could not be treated as ordinary objects subject to the vagaries of the rising and falling of human kingdoms and principalities. In the Psalter, as we have seen, the power of the divine presence was such that the entire city could be imbued with the glory of God. Pilgrims were instructed not only to come to Jerusalem to sacrifice, but to walk among the city's structures, gazing upon them and attending to their unparalleled holiness. In rabbinic texts, this idea was taken one step further. Here, pilgrims were attended to an even more extraordinary theophany. According to one text in the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Yoma, we read, Rabbi Katina said, whenever Israel came up to Jerusalem at the pilgrimage festivals, the three pilgrimage festivals during the year, the temple veils would be pulled apart for them, and the cherubim were shown to them, whose bodies were intertwisted one with the other. And they would be thus addressed, look, you are beloved before God as the love between a man and a woman. I can't help, when I read this text, of thinking of a striking Christian parallel here in a painting of Francesco della Piero. This is an image of the Holy of Holies with our two cherubim pulling back the parochet, or the inner veil, but here revealing not the Ark of the Covenant, but the new Ark, that is Mary, Mother of God. Instead of seeing the ark, the viewer contemplates Mary, the mother of God, who discreetly splits the front of her dress to reveal her womb, which holds the Son of God. It's similar, we might want to say, to a set of Russian dolls. God is nested within the womb of a woman nested within the tabernacle. We could take a look at other slides here. This is kind of based on here. If we take a look at this slide here, let's will this arrow go? Yeah. Won't appear on the, it appears on the wall, but if I move it here, it disappears. All right. So we'll have to do something. Go from, you know, one form of digital to another form of digital. So this is the veil This is, of course, the Holy of Holies. The Babylonian Talmud imagines us opening up these veils so that the worshipper standing here on the court can be treated to an epiphany of the deity, to see God, the temple not only as the place where you offer sacrifice, but you contemplate the way in which God indwells this place.
Oh, thank you. Is that better?
Yes.
Could you hear me before? Do I need to repeat everything I said? No? Okay, that's good. All right. You're confirming what my wife says. You know, I don't need a mic. It's impossible for me to whisper. Okay. She always elbow in the rib when I try to whisper. Okay. Back here. So we pull this back and we can see. So what Piero della Francesca has done, a kind of, you know, allegorical re-representation, is we have, and Mary is often in Christian liturgy going, you know, way back to the first millennium, identified as the new Ark of the Covenant. And so it's altogether appropriate that we can have these cherubim pulling back these veils, her opening up a slit discreetly in her dress to reveal for the viewer the Godhead who dwells within. And then I'll keep this. So. Since that the pointer disappears when we go on the screen, that's kind of a piece of magic that it disappears. But in any event, this is also, I think, worthy of looking. This is, you know, Second Temple Judaism, I think, kind of anticipating, in a sense, what happens with that image of Mary, in which these coins that were basically coins which were stamped out. What's the word I want, not stamped out?
Minted.
Minted. There we go. Thank you. Coins that were... See, I don't really usually think that I'm approaching the age of retirement, but when I can't recall words like minted, then I realize, you know, well, you know, maybe there is a screw loose up there. Anyways, let's take a look here. So at this these coins, they're interesting because the Bar Kokhba revolt, of course, the hope for independence from Rome and the rebuilding of the temple and the onset of the Messianic Age. What the coins reveal here is the hope for rebuilding of the temple is not so much the renewal of sacrifices. We can find that, but I mentioned that these two types of piety are independent, interrelated but independent. What is of interest in this coin is not so much the return of sacrifice, but here we have, this is a piece of furniture that represents the table brought to the front door of the temple and presumably exposed for viewers to gaze upon. Very much analogous to Greco-Roman coins of the same period that did the same thing, putting the city god, as it were, in front of the temple, and as the scholar Price and Trell say, the presentation would suggest the age-old custom of an epiphany, a god appearing in person before his worshippers. It's hard not to look at that coin and think of Piero della Francesca. Doesn't know that coin, doesn't know any of this stuff. He develops it all independently. But it reflects, by the very nature of its independent development, I think, the truth of the underlying image they both represent. And then, if we continue, well, I'll stop here. Now I'm starting to leave my realm of knowledge, but this is a church in Jordan, 5th or 6th century, and this is a depiction, of course, of the tabernacle with the fire on the altar on the outside, but all the doorways open leading to the very middle, and it's found significantly here by the chancel rail, which would have blocked the laity, and before the apse where the Eucharist would be celebrated. If I continued with these images, I'll stop here because here's another early church from Jordan where you can see the chancel rail and the apse in the background, all of that. That structure is deeply dependent on this. It's simply this now in its Christian frame of reference. Okay, let me bring this to a close. My point, so going back to our image from Piero della Francesca and the image of Mary presenting to the viewer the Christ child. My point today in looking at this material doesn't concern the cult of Mary. You can take a look at my book if you wish to see that developed further.
Rather, I wish, well, I guess I can use this mic. I got either mic. Someone want this mic?
Okay, thanks.
Rather, what I wish to suggest is that the church is the heir of a full range of tabernacle traditions. As we've seen, these priestly texts identify two thematic centers to this material, one related to sacrifice, which I have not spent a lot of time on today, but the other on which I have spent quite a bit of time, that of vision, indwelling. These two dimensions left a deep imprint on post-biblical Judaism, which celebrated both a cult of the temple vessels along with a cult of animal sacrifice. What I've tried to suggest today is that the church's practice of adoring the Blessed Sacrament in no way occludes the importance of the sacrifice of the Mass, as many critics of that practice are wont to claim, but is a deeply scriptural complement to it. In this sense, I would like to suggest that the act of adoration is truly, quote, in accordance with the scriptures. Thank you for your attention. I might, as a way of just kind of closing, something unrelated but related, this is Father Sebastian White here from the Magnificat. That's you, right? So when I was preparing all of this material for class at the University of Notre Dame during the years of COVID, I was reading one day, they always have in Magnificat a little, you know, spiritual excerpt from a spiritual writer, which are often quite beautiful. And one of them came from a Blessed Concepcion, Conchita Cabrera de Armida, never had heard of her before, wife, mother, and widow in Mexico, first Mexican laywoman to be beatified. But she has to say this with respect to the rite of adoration. She says, O Jesus of the Eucharist, O consecrated host, then this is the great transition, O envied monstrance, O blessed ciborium, beloved of my heart, that we see what I call this ontological usage, that we go from the Eucharistic wafer to anything that would touch the wafer also becomes the subject of her adoration. I think that's deeply dependent. I don't think she read Numbers 4 and was inspired by this. Again, she is inspired simply by the act of adoration, but that display of piety is exactly what I think we see in Numbers 4 and why this piety, I would suggest, is in accordance with the scriptures. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.